The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are recording this minutes after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky finished speaking to Congress. Really powerful address. I started my newsletter this morning, Morning Shots. And by the way, if you're a Bulwark Plus member, you will get all of our newsletters as well as all of our podcasts. But I started today's Morning Shots with a quote from Edward R. Murrow talking about Winston Churchill, that Churchill mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. By the way, if you think John F. Kennedy said that, he did. He actually just borrowed it from Murrow without attribution. And this is Murrow's full quote. "Now the hour had come for him to mobilize the English language and send it into battle, a spearhead of hope for Britain and the world. It sustained, it lifted the hearts of an island of people when they stood alone." And I wrote that before Zelensky spoke, but it really struck me that not only has Zelensky mobilized language, he's mobilized several languages, he's also mobilized the power of social media and video to defend his country. And you saw that with the appeal to Congress. So joining me once again on the podcast to talk about all of this, David Preece, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare. Welcome back, David.
Hi, Charlie. Good to be back.
Well, did you watch the speech? Because it was emotional. It was heartbreaking, but it was very, very pointed. And it's interesting that Zelensky not only sort of, you know, rouses people, but also, I mean, he pokes conscience. He throws shade.
Yeah, I did watch most of it. I say most of it because I'll admit that some of it I could not see clearly through the tears in my eyes during the video, but it was a good speech. Whenever there's simultaneous translation, you lose some of the pace and effect. So the first part of the speech in Ukrainian and translated, but he understood his audience because he's such a good speaker at visual imagery. He mentioned Mount Rushmore. He mentioned Pearl Harbor. He mentioned 9/11. He mentioned the I Have a Dream speech. He did a good job of making it relevant to this audience and building up to the appeal at the end for more support. I thought it was a great speech.
Yeah, no, he said, remember Pearl Harbor, remember September 11th. Our country experiences the same every day right now, every night now. Russia has turned the Ukrainian sky into a source of death of thousands of people. And then he channels Martin Luther King Jr., says, I have a dream. I the dream of giving more air support. He said, I need your decision, your help, which means exactly the same. If the no-fly zone is too much to ask, how about the kinds of defense systems that we need, S-300s and other similar systems? So what do you think he will get at this point?
I thought it was a clever appeal, realizing that a no-fly zone is probably not in the offing. It's a virtual act of war that NATO would be starting instead of playing the fully defensive role in the conflict. Knowing that that's not in the offing, he said, that's what we really need. But if you really can't do that, then here's a shopping list. And that shopping list probably can be done. Maybe not all of it, maybe not right away, but I don't expect that there's an inherent obstacle to all of those. So I think substantively, he hit it right. He described the situation. He did pull on our emotional strings a bit, and he did make the references to the audience. And then he built up to the appeal and closed with a strong appeal to say, hey, if you want to be leader of the world, you've got to be leader of the peace too. He said it, of course, better than I did. He also, I think, through that communications strategy, yes, Zelensky is good. And I think a lot of us have focused on Zelensky rising to the occasion and using his background in media. But I think you have to realize that no man does this alone. And he's got a communications team that hopefully we learn more about over time, because I feel they'll be studied in communications studies for years to come.
Yeah, I want to come back to that video, because you're obviously right. He didn't put that together himself, and that was not something that just happened. But I, mm-hmm. David, I have to push back on you on something you said. You talked about the no-fly zone. You said that this would be equivalent to an act of war that we, I think you used the word that we would have started.
Yeah.
No. Yep. Vladimir Putin started this war.
We would be inserting NATO aircraft.
It doesn't mean we started
Ukraine,
this war.
Which is not a NATO member.
We didn't start it. We didn't start the fire.
Well, okay. Well, Putin is attacking, you know, his own citizens. Should we fly NATO planes over Moscow too? I understand the appeal for a no-fly zone, but the idea is, you know, we've decided we're defending every inch of NATO territory. We've been very clear about that. That is why we have an alliance relationship with many countries in Europe. We do not have that relationship with Ukraine, and we could decide to enter the conflict, but guess what? Vladimir Putin, from the beginning, has been saying this is because of NATO's encroachment in Ukraine, and Ukraine is really more important to Russia. He wants it to be a conflict where he can claim, hey, look, NATO is the aggressor here. Now, is enforcing a no-fly zone aggression? Of course it is. You're saying, I'm going to shoot down your planes if they come into this territory, which is not covered by the NATO treaty. It is. Is it justifiable? That's a legitimate argument. Maybe it is justifiable. We obviously have gone to bat for countries that are not in airtight alliances.
Well, hold on. You say that it's aggression. The aggression is Russian planes in the airspace over Ukraine, which is not their country. They have invaded Ukraine. They are engaging in aggression. They declared a no-fly zone for anybody but themselves over another country's airspace. Yep. So how is it aggression for us to say, for example, we are going to begin humanitarian airdrops into Kyiv or other cities, and if you interfere with this, we will shoot you down. But basically saying we're going to go in there, don't come up, do not attack us, because this is what we're doing. I'm just afraid that by accepting this idea that it's tantamount to war, that we have ratified Vladimir Putin's red line. We've let him define what the act would be, and therefore deterred ourselves from a lot of things that we may find necessary at some point. For example, if there is the use of chemical weapons, or if there is a massive humanitarian disaster, say in Kyiv, now hasn't Biden boxed himself into a corner by saying that sending planes is the equivalent of starting World War III? No, it's not. This is a response to the aggression and the war that Vladimir Putin started, and we are simply trying to restore the sovereignty of Ukraine.
Yep, you've put a lot on the table there, Charlie. Yep. So let me try to tick off each of those. First of all, you're absolutely right. Russia is the aggressor in the overall conflict, and there's no false equivalency going on here that if NATO decides to take more aggressive action, that is equivalent to what Russia has done. Absolutely not. Russia is to blame for what has happened, and I would even put it solely on Vladimir Putin's shoulders, because clearly based on the way that information is flowing within the Russian system, this is not something he's going to be able to try to blame on somebody else. So let's call it out. It is Russian aggression and it is Putin's war. Got it. That being said, NATO did not decide to make Ukraine a member before the Russian invasion.
Yeah.
That was a choice that was on the table. They could have used Article 10 to invite Ukraine into NATO membership, and they did not. Now, that means there is not an obligation under international law to defend Ukraine, but that doesn't mean we can't defend Ukraine. Yeah. That means it's a choice to decide what is in the best strategic interests of the United States, of NATO, and what is likely to work to get to an outcome that we want. The hard part is what you described near the end of your list there. which is, what about the humanitarian situation? Listen, there have been humanitarian situations around the world for decades that the United States has not intervened in. Some of them, the decision makers later express great regret for. Rwanda is the big one that's often cited here, but you can point to the Democratic Republic of the Congo with absolute horrors going on, and the United States did not intervene. Ukraine may be a different situation. That's a debate that is worth having, and it is being had in circles of power in Washington. That's great. We want to decide when we should intervene, even outside of alliance commitments. You can't have that conversation without thinking of the box that we have put Putin in, the near unanimity among the West in terms of sanctions against Putin, in terms of the attitude that Putin is solely responsible for this, and Putin's lack of an excuse to say, but NATO did it, but see, NATO just wanted to attack Russia all along. We have essentially taken that argument away from him by arming the Ukrainians and letting them fight, but not intervening directly. And
I guess I'm not worried about
it. We need to note giving that if you do a no-fly zone, people think of that as some, oh, it's a nice thing, we're just going to defend humanitarian airdrops. But what you're doing is you're putting American planes and other NATO planes in direct combat with Russian planes. And that's something we avoided pretty well during the Cold War for decades. And that mostly turned out well. So yeah, let's have that debate. Let's figure out if we want to change that and if we want to hand Putin what he wants. But I'll channel our friend Tom Nichols here and say, you can't pretend that that's not what we're doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously there is some risk there. So I want to just double back on something we were talking about, the video that he showed, and you made the point that he's got a very, very skilled team working for him. Yeah. I'm always looking for things that change the dynamic. And of course, we've done this over the last 6 years and have discovered over and over again that nothing changes anything. I think that's my default setting. But you have to wonder, because these images are so powerful. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Zelensky brings to the table here that is awfully interesting. I mean, obviously, his character, his courage are, you know, first and foremost, but also his willingness to use the bully pulpit of his role, I think, is extraordinary. But he also understands, because of his entertainment background, mm-hmm. that simply words aren't enough. That this is not 1940, where giving the speech is enough. And so it was kind of an extraordinary moment when he shows a video to members of Congress. Let me just read a couple of these tweets here. This is Jackie Alemany from the Washington Post, who said, Zelensky plays a gutting video juxtaposing scenes of a peaceful Ukraine with stark shots of Russian attacks, destruction, and death, scenes of soldiers tossing the dead in ditches, crying children, injured babies, obliterated landscapes. The video concludes, close the sky over Ukraine. Bianca Golodriga writes, wow, this video Zelensky showed Congress of a peaceful and thriving country just 3 weeks ago, completely torn apart by war, is incredibly moving and heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Ukraine is truly fighting this war on all fronts, including through powerful cinematography. Here's another tweet. Lawmakers inside the room are wiping away tears while watching this video mm-hmm. of Ukrainian cities and citizens getting obliterated. Heart-wrenching stuff. So clearly, this is going to ratchet up the pressure on Biden to do things that he has not done. Now, he is going to announce this morning, probably while you and I are talking, $800 million in additional military assistance, which I suppose is good. I guess the question is, are there weapon systems that we're going to give them now that for some reason we had decided earlier we weren't going to give them? And if so, why? Do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, this is where the details will really matter. Yeah, What I'm anticipating, I don't know this for sure, but what I'm anticipating is that there will be some movement either in the announcement this morning or within the coming days for some of the more advanced drone technology we have, for additional missile batteries, whether it's just surface-to-air or surface-to-ship missiles, because of the proposed amphibious landings near Odessa and other regions that could happen. I don't know exactly which systems will be coming and which restrictions the military or the political leadership will want to put on them. But this is the kind of thing that can help close the skies, right? The Ukrainians can shoot down and have shot down some Russian air assets quite effectively. And without putting in a no-fly zone, you can actually affect the situation on the battlefield by getting the weapons in while we can. And the Russians may have taken a few airstrikes in the western part of the country, perhaps as some kind of a warning shot saying, we know you're bringing weapons in over here. We really wish you wouldn't do that. But instead of backing down, what we've done is amp it up. You've even had the prime ministers of Poland and Czechia and Slovenia visit Zelensky by coming in from the West.
That was powerful. They took a train.
It is. And it's a big middle finger to Putin saying, you are conducting the largest ground operations in Europe since World War II. You have invaded a peaceful neighbor. You're doing a horrific thing. And you think that we're all going to sit back and let you do it. Well, maybe we are not rolling the tanks in to stop you, but we are not afraid to treat this like the independent country that it is and continue to operate as if we can fly there safely or take the train there safely or send weapons as countries do to another all the time. We're going to continue on business as usual.
Yeah,
that probably bothers Putin as much as the loss of an aircraft in the sky.
Well, let me ask you this. I have to admit that I guess I have been functioning under this assumption that our European allies were always the weak link, that they would be soft, that they would be the most likely to appease Vladimir Putin or cut some sort of a deal. I am amazed at the strength that we are seeing from Europeans, including obviously these are Eastern Europeans. But I mean, when you're seeing the Danes increasing their military budget, the Germans, this is an extraordinary moment. And it makes you think that the international structure that we have just taken for granted is fundamentally changing right now. I mean, are you surprised by how strong Europe has been in standing up to this?
I am not surprised how strong much of Europe has been. That is, the Estonians and others. I fully expected that they would take a position like this. The Germans, I had my questions about, and some others farther away from Central and Eastern Europe. But those who are closest to Russia know it best. It was back probably 15 years ago now in Georgia when the Polish prime minister, I believe it was, visited and said after the Russian incursion in Georgia, he said, we know very well that today it is Georgia, tomorrow it will be Ukraine, the day after tomorrow the Baltic states, and perhaps the next one in line will be my country, Poland. They understand this. They've been through it. And that's part of why they wanted to join NATO as a defensive alliance, not an offensive alliance. They wanted to join a league of nations that would defend each other against this country that has repeatedly committed aggression against them. The other Europeans standing up to me is a reflection of, honestly, how well the Ukrainians played this before the conflict. Zelensky got a lot of criticism for doing things like not mobilizing and not rushing troops up to the border to stop the invasion. Well, he didn't give Putin the excuse that, you know, he somehow was reacting to a Ukrainian provocation. He allowed Russia to be so blatantly the aggressor that it would have been very difficult for even recalcitrant Europeans to say that this did not need to be met with the sternest measures they could muster.
Well, your wheelhouse, David, is intelligence, and it's really interesting watching the way the Biden administration has used intelligence. And I want to talk about that right after this. So have you ever searched for something online that you wouldn't want other people knowing about? I spend a lot of time researching conspiracy theories, and I go down some dark rabbit holes, and frankly, I don't want to leave that much of a trail. Now, I know that most of you are thinking, why don't you use incognito mode? Well, let me tell you something. Incognito mode does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history, because your internet service provider can still see every single website you've ever visited. That's why even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter who your internet provider is. ISPs in the United States can legally sell your information to ad companies, and ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers, so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Now, most of the time, I don't even realize I have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background, and it's so easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button, and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all of your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV, so there's really no excuse for you not to be using it. So protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by Business Insider. Visit my exclusive link, expressvpn.com/bulwark, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's expressvpn.com/bulwark. expressvpn.com/bulwark to learn more. Okay, we are back with David Priest from Lawfare. David, this is your area of expertise, the use of intelligence. Let's talk about that, because this has been one of the, I think, signature moves of the Biden administration is to constantly be, you know, putting out things that we have found out about what the Russians are thinking about, what they're doing, what they are planning. So talk to me a little bit about this strategy, what we know, how we know it, and sure. Maybe contrast it a little bit with the kind of intelligence that Vladimir Putin is or is not getting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's go build back to Russia after we walk through the U.S. side. So there have been months and months. I mean, this is going back well before the Russian invasion of authorized disclosures about Russian capability and intent. And it's important to distinguish authorized disclosures from leaks or unauthorized disclosures. Intel and security types hate the latter because that is somebody deciding to take sensitive information and put it out there, often for personal gain. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about authorized disclosures, the U.S. government deciding to put sensitive information out there for a diplomatic or strategic purpose. Now, those of us with an intelligence background reflexively react negatively to those two, but we have to realize that's why we collect intelligence, to either use it in decision-making or use it in the real world to affect reality on the ground. And it has been a remarkable operation. I'm impressed with the way that the Biden administration has used intelligence without divulging sources and methods to both try to preempt Russian action and to lay the groundwork for coordinated action against Russia if Russia did invade anyway. Notice how the releases mentioned what we had found out that Russia was doing or planning to do, but never how we knew it.
Yes.
Now, that could raise the question, well, why do we believe you? You know, it does require some credibility. The audience has to think that you're not just making this up. Well, guess what? We had that because of the long history of past Russian duplicity and demonstrable aggressions in Chechnya, in Crimea, in Syria, in the Donetsk Basin or the Donbass, even against dissidents like Alexander Litvinenko and Sergei Skripal. There was credibility because this fit with past Russian behavior. To me, I found it remarkable that so much was being put out there, and yet it wasn't pointing to any particular source. Yeah. Russian spy chiefs may have been guessing how the Americans were learning about these different things, but in fact, that probably just made them more paranoid because it was never specific enough.
Yeah, this had to get inside Vladimir Putin's head with looking around. How do they know that? Where are they getting this from? I mean,
absolutely,
that has got to make them suspicious of one another. So that's sort of a collateral benefit.
Right. And the one thing I didn't see is anything so specific in the authorized disclosures that you could point to it and say, we would only know that if we had this specific phone, or we would only know this if this person in Putin's inner circle was telling it to us. I never saw anything that could be that specific. Instead, I would imagine you had Putin and his spy chiefs looking around saying, okay, it could be signals intercepts. It could be communications intercepts. It could be human intelligence. It could be some other technical collection, making them more paranoid. And yet day after day, it continued. And I think it's a case study in the effective use of intelligence to both try to prevent an invasion, which did not work, but then the reason that we have had such great success in coordinated action across the Western world is in part because of this buildup, because of this intelligence that was put out there in advance, knowing what Russia was going to do. They did it anyway. Russia could not play the game where it didn't happen or it was due to something else. It was all out there, and I think that's masterful.
What do you think, let's flip this around, the intelligence of Vladimir Putin he's getting, because clearly he miscalculated a lot of things, including the big one, which was if he really did believe or someone told him that the Ukrainians would greet the Russians as liberators. I mean, that will go down as one of the great blunders, I think, in military history. Your thoughts about that, the quality of his intelligence, which is interesting because he's a KGB guy, so this should be his this should be his speciality, right?
Well, I think there's
he should be good at this.
I think there's a simple explanation for at least most of that, and I don't know this. This is speculation, but it is based on the fact that in the Russian system, there is not the same culture of telling truth to power as there is in the United States system and most Western intelligence services. What I mean by that is that the job of an intelligence analyst when I was doing the job is to write pieces, and the job of an intelligence briefer when I was taking those pieces to the White House and elsewhere. The job is to tell the policymaker what she needs to hear, not what she wants to hear or what he wants to hear. The whole point is to put forward uncomfortable truths. This is what's going on. And maybe you recognize as a briefer that this is going to anger the policymaker because that person has just put a whole lot of time and effort. And maybe they have staked their next election on this policy that they're doing working out. And you're presenting them something that's showing them this policy that you're doing isn't really working out very well on the ground overseas. You're not saying that, but that's what the intelligence definitely implies to them. That is an occupational risk of being in intelligence in the United States, is you might have to go to someone who's very powerful, who can wag their finger in your face and tell you you're not being helpful for U.S. policy. And you're saying, in fact, I am, because I'm describing reality the best way we can see it. Now, contrast that with Russia. We had an interesting statement just a few days ago from Andrei Kozarev, who was the Russian foreign minister in the 1990s. And he said that Putin's top security chiefs were more likely to overthrow Putin than they are to actually tell him bad news.
Interesting.
And that's striking. They would actually rather take the risk of a coup and put themselves at physical risk than they would be to walk in a room and say, Mr. Putin, this is the way we're seeing things on the ground in Ukraine. That means he's not getting the kind of accurate information one needs to have something like a successful invasion. Put aside all the armchair psychology and other distance diagnoses of Putin's mental and physical conditions. Just what information is he actually getting before making a choice to invade a neighbor? Ooh, he's not getting good intelligence. That's almost entirely clear.
Well, obviously, he's also gotten bad information about the quality of his military. He spent billions of dollars and I think was probably under the impression that he had a world-class military. So all of this is, has got to be a huge shock to him. And this also goes back to whether or not members of the leaders of the military were willing to honestly report what the conditions were, what their readiness level was, or the fact that a lot of that money might have been scammed off rather than effectively invested. You know, we keep talking about the Russian economy and what the impact of the sanctions on the Russian economy, and they're obviously going to be quite severe. I think it's interesting how Putin is reacting to all of this. Yesterday, he signed this law that makes it possible to nationalize the 500-some airplanes that Western leasing companies are demanding be returned to them, and they're worth about $10 billion. So basically, what he's doing is he's stealing the planes, and he's basically saying, "Yeah, we're gonna do this." JVL had a great point in his newsletter yesterday. He said, you know, sanctions are like a valve. You can turn them on and you can turn them off. But once you blow up the rule of law to such a degree that foreign capital realizes that they'd be insane to invest anything in your economy because you might steal it, you can't come back easily from that. So Putin, rather than taking steps to cushion this, is taking steps that I think will make it much harder to attract foreign investment as long as he's in power, because people are going, well, so wait, there is no rule of law there. They will just steal our stuff mm-hmm. if we let them have it. That's going to have long-term implications.
Yeah, sanctions are a funny thing, Charlie, because if you look at the history of them in modern times, you can find plenty of case studies where they were woefully ineffective when it came to affecting strategic national decisions. But you can also find cases where they were remarkably effective. And what that means is fans of sanctions and opponents of sanctions come to very different conclusions because they can cherry pick their case studies. But what you look at with Russia is you have a country that is more highly integrated into the global economy, or was a few weeks ago, in percentage terms than you'd expect. Its share of imports to GDP is over 20%, which is higher than India or even China. So that's why the economic sanctions against Russia are so blistering, a cost of probably hundreds of billions of dollars to the Russian economy already, which is amazing. So the reactions, what do you do? Well, one reaction, and we would say the reaction that we would want to have, is Putin would say, you know what, it ain't worth it. I'll come up with some excuse why this is someone else's fault. I'll pull back. I'll claim victory, and we'll try to get those sanctions lifted, and I'll play off the Europeans against each other like I used to, and I'm sure it'll work. That's one strategy.
Right.
He's not done that yet. I still think he'll get there, but he's not there yet. Strategy two, in the short term, you grab all the money you can. You keep people from converting rubles to dollars. You nationalize what you can. You take advantage of the limited means you have simply to keep things afloat temporarily. And then you have the third option, which is who is it who is not part of this sanctions effort that might actually bail us out and see us as some kind of a tool to use against the West? Well, there's this country called China, right?
That's it, yeah.
And so Russia looks to China, and China, in fact, it looks like has been looking very interestingly at some of the, especially the hydrocarbon development that Western companies have pulled out of. Will China come and be the trillion-dollar rescuer of Russia? I'm not a China analyst, and I don't know the motivations of the Chinese government, but it certainly would look like they will help in some way economically, but not do a full bailout of Russia if it looks like they would have to be carrying this massive load for a long time. But that, to me, is the interesting angle, is Putin is trying both the short-term and the long-term means to relieve the sanctions, not because they're ineffective, but because they are so effective and they are actually having an impact even after just a couple of weeks.
So let's shift gears just a little bit. I want to play a little bit of sound for you.
Every time you do that, Charlie, it makes me sad or angry.
Well, that is the point, I think, you know. But also it can be slightly entertaining, you know. Sort of, there must be like a word for, you know, being entertained by getting angry. Let me work on that. So we haven't played any Tucker Carlson or any of his propaganda, but this Tulsi Gabbard thing is just weird. I mean, there are people out there who I just have become willing dupes. I don't know whether useful idiot is a appropriate term anymore, because I think that they know exactly what they're doing. But Tulsi Gabbard, who was a Democratic congresswoman, she was Democratic candidate for president, and suddenly now has become the darling of the pro-Putin right. She's on Fox News again yesterday, and she's on with Jesse Waters, so, you know, perhaps not the most serious guy on the air. And she makes a point about the silencing of Fox. This has, of course, been a big theme on the right, you know, that we have this totalitarian attack on free speech, that conservatives are being silenced. Of course, you know, they're saying this on, you know, to millions of people on cable news, but they're continuing to pound on this. And I think, you know, maybe they, you know, on Earth 2.0, they'd be embarrassed by the juxtaposition of actual censorship, like what we're seeing in Russia, versus their complaints about Twitter. No, they're not shamed. They're beyond that. But I want to play this little exchange. So Jesse Waters, you know, says right before Tulsi comes on, the liberal media is calling for a silencing of Fox News since the invasion of Ukraine, because if you raise questions outside the mainstream, you are the enemy of the state. So here's Tulsi.
Tulsi, it is striking when you see Putin propaganda and you line it up against Biden propaganda.
What?
Do you think that we're at risk of kind of moving in that direction right now?
What an asshat.
We are moving in that direction, Jesse. And your question there, what are they so afraid of? They're afraid of the truth. They're afraid of even a single voice coming out as challenging the power elite, questioning them, daring to hold a dissenting view. And they're afraid because their arguments are so weak that they know they will not withstand the light of the truth.
Okay, the light of the truth. We're getting this from Tulsi Gabbard. Okay, so this is Trump world giving us like the light of the truth. So, okay, so then she adds this.
And this is what's so dangerous about the place that we're in right now as a country, where this idea, this principle, this foundation of freedom of speech, freedom of expression is directly under threat and under attack. And you're right, it's not so different. What's happening here is not so different from what we're seeing happening in Russia, where you've got state TV and controlled messaging across the board. This is where we're at.
Oh, Charlie, you've done it. You've made me both sad and angry in large. This is unbelievable. I mean, I thought Marianne Williamson was the candidate in that pool who was talking about light and getting out of control. But this, the threat she's talking about isn't real. But let me come back to that, because in a sense, it's becoming real for her. But you're trying to compare. She's going on Fox News. Fox News is still invited to the daily White House briefings. So I don't know how they're not being allowed to ask questions and how they're being shut down. She obviously is speaking to tens of millions of watchers on all cable networks that Fox is carried by. Meanwhile, in Russia, the system that she is literally equating this to, you have to remember, this goes back 20 years. In 2006, the Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya was shot and killed in the elevator of her apartment in central Moscow.
Well, that's almost like having your Twitter account suspended, right? This is the same.
It's insulting.
In Russia, you get 15 years in jail for saying that Vladimir Putin's war is a war. That's in Russia. Here, Twitter might actually suspend your account. Pretty much the same thing, right, David?
And
I mean, really, it's pretty much, there's no, how do you draw a distinction between that? This is where we're going. Right.
And the danger, Charlie, is not that it's so ridiculous, because we recognize this, and I'm almost literally banging my head against the wall right now just listening to it. But I go to Brian Kloss, who I know you've had on the podcast before.
Yeah,
he's got that great book on corruption.
Yeah,
he wrote an Atlantic article that just posted this morning, and I love his lines in there. It's about Putin, and it's about, you know, demystifying this idea of the great dictator and the despot who's the savvy genius. But this actually really applies to what we're listening to right now as well. He said, if you live in a fake world long enough, it can start to feel real. Despots begin to believe their own lies. Well, it's not just despots. It's also people like Tulsi Gabbard, who I think has put herself into a fake world, is filtering everything to fit in with her preconceived beliefs. And guess what? To her, that probably does start to feel real, and you will find any confirming evidence you can and disbelieve anything that does not support your narrative. It's actually not different than what he's talking about with Putin. So she's right, but she's right in the reverse sense, which is she is more like the situation in Russia than the people she's criticizing.
I think you're right. Now, I was actually going to talk a little bit about what's going on with Lara Logan, who used to be a really respected international reporter for CBS, who's now too crazy for Fox News. But, you know, she was on spouting some stuff. I'm not going to do that now because
you've caused us enough pain.
Well, you know, Ms. Tulsi Gabbard, I think, is a witting dupe of Russia. I think something's wrong with Lara Logan. I mean, seriously, I mean, I think she's damaged in some fundamental way. And I did. So in some ways, it almost feels like picking on her. Okay, so could we have one final section here in
Absolutely.
The podcast? So when I was a kid, my favorite board game by far was Stratego.
Yes.
I saw you tweeted about that.
I did.
I hadn't thought about Stratego in years, but it all came flooding back to me. That was a great game.
It was. It was a game that, obviously, it's in the name, Stratego. It involved strategy, but as an eight-year-old kid, you're not thinking of the levels of logic and all of that. It's just a fun game.
No, but you learn stuff. Yep. I mean, this was one of the things where you had to develop the strategy. Where do you put those bombs? You know, where does the colonels go? Where do the majors go? Where does the general go?
And like any great game, a truly great game, it combines the gameplay. That is, like you said, you have to know these are the pieces I have. This is how I'm going to deploy them. But it involves the psychology of the opponent. You have to figure out, you know what? When I was 8 years old and I played it with my dad always used the brute force method, or my dad tended to use this method. But does he know that I know that? So you end up playing a two-level game, one with the actual pieces themselves, and one is trying to figure out the psychology of the opponent. So this game was on my mind because we were cleaning out some old shelves, you know, and I found the 7 versions of Risk that we've accumulated over the years for playing with my son. And Monopoly apparently will make a game for anything. Apparently, I don't know if it's even a meme or not that there's a new Bridgerton Monopoly. Right, I don't know if that's the case. But it is Stratego... True, yeah. Was oddly hard to find, at least in the version that I remember it, where you had the little plastic pieces that had the stickers on them that moved across the board. And I remembered that board game cover. And so I found the picture of it and just, you know, put out there in the world that I missed it. And I don't know whether it's because of the stress we're all under, but that received more of a reaction than almost any take I put out there on intelligence and national
security.
Isn't
that interesting? Well, I'll tell you, I had another take as well. I started thinking about other games that I remembered as a kid, and there's another game that I've been thinking about a lot lately that is kind of obscure, but probably had as much influence on me as anything I learned in school. And I mean this quite literally. It was a game called Propaganda. Do you remember this game at all?
I do. It was not nearly as popular, but it was
No. Because it's much more sort of cerebral, and it's 12 and up. But I looked it up and, you know, found it's 1966 game. The game consists of an 88-page book, which includes the rules of play, descriptions of numerous propaganda techniques, 40 cards containing propaganda quotations, and prediction dials and a scorecard. So basically, they read you a statement. You read a statement, and players decide whether or not the statement, you know, which category of propaganda comes from, like self-deception, language, irrelevance, exploitation, ad hominem attack. It teaches you how to recognize bad faith chop logic. And I think in many ways, I think I've drawn on that game over the years because, you know, if you spend any time on Twitter, you go, well, that argument, you know, would fall into that category. That argument would fall into that category. Well, you know, why would you go with the straw man if you actually have facts and data? So, and the way it works is player reads a quote, then all the players secretly decide which technique is being employed. Is it ad hominem, self-deception, or something? And then there's a majority rule. I mean, each player who did not vote with a majority then, you know, tries to convince the popular voters to change their vote. So it actually, you have this discussion back and forth and you have debate and you have to use your critical sensibilities. What a great game for young kids, teaching them, you know, keep talking about critical thinking or how do you spot fake news or lack of logic or linear thought. This game needs to have a comeback. Really?
It really does. And nothing against mathematicians. I know I'm going to alienate 0.5% of the audience today, but nothing against mathematicians. I understand that there are valuable reasons in the world to learn calculus. I just don't know what any of those reasons are. And I have never missed the absence of calculus or pre-calculus in my life. But I remember in junior high or high school, instead, I had the option, do you take pre-calc? Or do you take probability and statistics? And I took the latter. And I have found that to be immensely useful in real life when it comes to everything from understanding purchase choices, from cars to houses, to understanding risks of things ranging from car accidents to airplane accidents to lightning strikes. And I have a feeling that we could actually do better as a country if we took the pre-calculus class in high school and just pushed that out the window. And instead said, everybody for an entire year of class will play this propaganda game because that game will teach you better life skills and prevent the kind of susceptibility to disinformation and misinformation. And that would be better for our country than just about any other educational reform I can think of.
I cannot tell you how strongly I agree with you here. So let's end on that note. of radical violent agreement. David Priest, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow. We will do this all over again.